So it's been great to be here. I should thank John Belinsky and Lucien for inviting me to come over and tell you about some of the things that interest me these days. So as you might guess from the title, this is going to be a talk on condensed matter physics. Conventional condensed matter physics is a fairly mature subject, and the conceptual basis of many of the things that we've been doing in this field rests on two important ideas due to this man, Landau. So the first idea that Landau came up with that is very important is to point out, is to focus on the possibility that in a many-electron system, such as is realized in inside a metallic solid or inside a superconductor or a magnet or whatever, that in this many-electron system, individual electrons still retain their integrity so long as you don't disturb the system too violently. So the electron survives in the form of a quasi-particle in various phases of electronic matter, even though microscopically you expect it to scatter strongly of many, many other of the many other electrons that exist inside this medium, right? So this concept of a quasi-particle, of an electron that survives as a quasi-particle, is the basis for our description of metals, itself, of insulators, superconductors, various kinds of magnetic metals, and so on and so forth. So it's a really fundamental concept upon which the entire theory of conducting systems is based. Now, the other important idea that Landau came up with is the notion of an order parameter to describe various phases of matter. And it's closely related to this other idea of central importance in physics, that of spontaneously broken symmetries. So the order parameter quantifies the amount of symmetry breaking that exists in a phase of matter. And as people presume, everyone here knows, the concept of the order of the Landau order parameter provides the basis of the modern theory of phase transitions, which again Landau played a huge role in developing. So let me very quickly review all of conventional condensed matter physics in 10 minutes, a crash course in condensed matter theory. So Landau Fermi liquid theory is the crowning example of Landau's invocation of the quasi-particle idea. It's the most subtle application of that idea. So the electrons, the free mobile electrons inside a metal, we all know they should be described as a quantum fluid of fermions at typical temperatures that you examine a metal in. The degeneracy temperature of the electrons is much higher than the temperature, so that quantum statistics is important. So the inter-electron spacing in a typical metal is on the order of an angstrom, so the Coulomb repulsion between electrons is huge, and it's comparable to the kinetic energy of the electrons. Nevertheless, the effects of the Coulomb interactions are dramatically weakened because of the Pauli principle. So the free Fermi gas, you fill up a Fermi sphere in momentum space, and the states inside the Fermi sphere are occupied, and they are unable to participate in any further scattering. Right? So in terms of the states that are available for scattering, the states inside the Fermi surface are more or less dead. They are inert, and they remove phase space for scattering, and that mitigates the effect of the interaction between the electrons coming from Coulomb repulsion. Weakening of the interactions means that one can more or less make a model of the electrons inside a metal by pretending that they were free non-interacting electrons, and that model describes most metals extremely well. So Landau's other idea, the order parameter, let me illustrate it by reviewing the example of a ferromagnet. So the ferromagnetic state, the microscopic spin, so the electrons all line up in a nice pattern. While if you increase the temperature to disorder the ferromagnetism, the spins are all, fluctuating thermally, and a snapshot would look something like that, and this configuration would change, function of time. So in this context, the spontaneous magnetization of the ferromagnet is the order parameter, and the ordered phase spontaneously breaks spin rotation symmetry. Okay. So let's now think about the phase transition from the ferromagnet to the paramagnet. So the phenomena associated with this phase transition things like singularities in various physical quantities, which are Paul law, as a function of the deviation of temperature from the critical temperature. The phenomenon of universality. Different systems, irrespective of microscopic detail, show the same kinds of singularities. There's the phenomenon of scaling, and so on and so forth. So Landau said that the way to think about these critical phenomena, the fundamental degrees of freedom responsible for the singularities are the long wavelength fluctuations of his order parameter. Right? He said those are the things one must blame. And this idea was developed into a very sophisticated theoretical framework through the course of many decades of work, culminating in this so-called Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson paradigm, which takes Landau's ideas that these are the important fluctuations and combines it with the renormalization group to provide you with a complete theoretical framework for describing critical phenomena. So the loss of magnetism on heating occurs due to thermal fluctuations. Now, you could also imagine a phase transition that occurs as a function of some parameter at zero temperature, as a function of some parameter in your Hamiltonian, in the quantum Hamiltonian. So this is what's known as a quantum phase transition, something that many of you, I'm sure, have heard of. So this is driven by the quantum zero-point motion, quantum fluctuations of the degrees of freedom rather than the thermal fluctuations of whatever degrees of freedom you have. So there is a Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson description of these quantum phase transitions as well, which builds on the success of the standard theory of thermal phase transitions. So the idea here is that since we're dealing with a quantum system, we have to worry both about the long wavelength and about long time fluctuations. And following Landau, let's say we blame it all on the fluctuations of the order parameter degrees of freedom. So one would then be describing this quantum phase transition by a suitable continuum quantum field theory at zero temperature. And this description is successful in describing many, many quantum critical phenomena. So that's my review of the conceptual basis of a huge portion of quantum condensed matter physics. It really rests heavily on these two ideas of Landau. So one of the exciting things, the most exciting thing that's happening in the field right now is that in the last two and a half decades, both of these ideas have been challenged in serious ways by various discoveries. The oldest is the fractional quantum Hall effect, high temperature superconductivity, and there's a continuing series of discoveries that have forced us to question the general validity of both of Landau's ideas. And many, many fundamental questions have been raised in the field in the last few years, 20 years. Some of them have been answered, but clearly not all. There's a lot of very, very basic conceptual questions that we're still struggling with. So I wanted to give you an example of some of the questions that we're struggling with in this area of physics, particularly because I got the sense that at least some of you may not have had that much exposure to the frontiers of condensed matter physics here. So one example of a question that's been actively discussed in the field is whether the electron necessarily needs to survive as a quasiparticle in any given phase of matter. Right? So Landau said, look, that's the most reasonable thing to happen, and all of textbook solid-state physics assumes that it does, but does it have to? And that's a question we are confronting right now. Even more fundamentally, Thus, every quantum phase necessarily need to have any elementary set of excitations from which you can build up an orbitary excitation, right? So one way to think about it is to imagine that you're a microorganism that's living inside a solid, and imagine you're doing particle physics and you want to describe the universe that you see around you. You don't have enough money to buy a super high energy, to build a super high energy accelerator, so you're only restricted to doing relatively low energy experiments, so you don't really know that underlying the solid you have electrons. So then what would your universe look like? So one could ask, what's the particle data book going to look like in this universe? And you can make up a list of particles. Those would be quasi-particles. But a more fundamental question is, you know, does the universe need to have particles at all in this context? Right? Do you need to have elementary excitations in any given phase of matter? The answer is not at all clear. And modern work shows that there are phases of matter where there are no quasi-particles at all. Right? So there's no quasi-particle description of the spectrum. So metals, we learn in textbook solid-state physics that a metal is something that has a Fermi surface. Is that really true? And again, the answer is not at all clear. Both theory and experiment suggests the possible existence of metals which don't have Fermi surfaces, even when they're clean. You know, does the metallic state require that the charge carriers be fermionic? Electrons are, of course, fermions, but can bosons form a mobile state, a state in which they are a fluid where they are a metal? Right? Again, you know, theory strongly suggests that they can form a metal. Experiments, there's no experiments hasn't answered this question yet. And finally, you know, was Landau correct in saying that this notion of symmetry breaking captures the order in a phase? And again, this question has been answered. It's clear that it's not. Is symmetry breaking the only route to ordering? I mean, we know the quantum Hall effect example tells us that it's not. And is it always correct that Landau's identification of the culprits for critical singularities at a phase transition, is that always correct? And we again know theoretically that this is this statement, that it's not always correct, that there's lots of situations in which something other than the order parameter fluctuations are responsible for the singularities at a critical point. So all of these are basic conceptual questions that the field has had to come to grips with, and is, in some cases has come to grips with, and in others is struggling to come to grips with, and hopefully will make progress on questions such as these in coming years. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on one particular set of questions associated with metals where Landau's Fermi liquid theory breaks down. There's a lot of experimental sightings of such metals in the last 20 years, but there's almost no theory. There are many interesting ideas that are, you know, scattered ideas, but there's no theoretical framework that exists as things stand to describing what we colloquially call strange metals. So a common phase diagram would look like this. So this temperature and this some parameter, such as pressure or magnetic field that you're tuning, and you drive the system at low temperature from some phase to some other phase, and you in this region of the phase diagram, you often find behavior that is very, very unconventional and is cannot be described within the framework of Fermi liquid theory. So the most notorious example comes from the high-temperature superconductors, which, so this is the famous phase diagram of the superconductors. So the thing that I want to draw your attention to is not so much the superconductivity, but what happens above the superconducting transition, and it's a strange non-Fermi liquid metal, and indeed, this region of the phase diagram is the most mysterious to this day of the entire phase diagram of the high-temperature superconductors. Everywhere else, we can make up some story which seems reasonable, but for this, we don't have any story that looks halfway reasonable. Right? So one example of a phenomenon which is well documented from the early days of the field and still remains completely mysterious is the temperature dependence of the electrical resistivity measured in this region, and here's a plot. It's linear in T. So it's a very simple law, right? Resistivity is linear in T. Now, this is difficult for the for us because within Fermi liquid theory, resistivity is supposed to go like T squared. So we have a law that does not agree with the predictions of Fermi liquid theory, but yet is remarkably simple, right? And we don't have an explanation or, you know, anything which is even halfway, I mean, anything that looks remotely like an explanation of the simple law. Now, there are many, many other examples. Let me highlight one that I've thought a bit about. So it turns out that there are these various rare earth alloys, things that involve elements like cerium and ytterbium and so on, which undergo a magnetic ordering phase transition at zero temperature as a function of some tuning parameter. And in the vicinity of this magnetic ordering phase transition, there is again a non-Fermi liquid phase, a non-Fermi liquid regime that develops that is again very mysterious. So here's an example of a phase diagram on one such material. So this is driven from a paramagnetic Fermi liquid to a magnetic metal through a phase transition. And there's this orange region of very unusual behavior near that phase transition. For instance, the resistivity as a function of temperature is once again obeys this remarkably simple law. It's just linear in temperature. And once again, we have no idea at all of what's going on as an explanation of this and other simple phenomena that have been measured in this region, right in this region. Right? So what is the origin? Yeah, sorry. Okay, so so superconductivity is colloquially called high-temperature superconductivity because it's high compared to what was known before. But in terms of the natural energy scales in the system, the TC is still very low. So non-Fermi liquid regime is what happens above the superconducting transition temperature. No, so it's a phase diagram of this sort, right, where this could be your superconducting blip. Right? So when plotted in terms of natural energy scales, the blip of superconductivity is really this small. Right? We still call it high temperature superconductivity because it's higher than what people knew before. Okay, so what is the origin of this non-Fermi liquid physics? Now, a naive guess would be to say, you know, a natural no-brainer guess would be to say, look, it's occurring near this quantum phase transition. So whatever is driving that phase transition, the fluctuations of that is what's giving you the non-Fermi liquid physics. So okay, so we know how to calculate universal properties of phase transition, you know, Landau taught us. So then we say that the universal physics associated with this quantum critical point gives you the non-Fermi liquid physics, and that's the end of the story. So what we're trying to do then is to try to use one idea of Landau to kill the other idea of Landau. Use Landau's ideas on phase transitions to kill his ideas on Fermi liquid theory. Of course, Landau doesn't want to kill himself. And so this program doesn't work. So this obvious suggestion doesn't work at all. So these natural assumptions have difficulty giving you what you see in experiments. And it's a reasonably mature, you know, no theory is completely worked out, but this reasonably mature theory of the fluctuations of the magnetic order parameter making allowance for the metallic environment, which is spectacularly inconsistent with the non-Fermi liquid physics that's actually seen in the experiments. Right? So clearly, we need something different. So we have to abandon, you know, not only Landau's theory of Fermi liquids, we also had to abandon Landau's theory of phase transitions. So this is a real crisis for us. It's everything. You know, at least everything I learned in grad school is useless for me, right, in terms of what we're going to do next. So the way to proceed, there are obviously different ways that one can try to proceed, but one thing that one may want to do is to take more clues from experiments. So let me talk to you about some of the things that experiments tells us on what, you know, what we should base our thinking on. So it turns out that experiments tell us that one of the phenomena that may be going on in the vicinity of these known Fermi liquid regimes is that the Fermi surface of your metal may be dying on you, that you may be killing the Fermi surface. So at many such zero-temperature phase transitions in metals, we've learned from experiments that the entire Fermi surface of the metal may disappear and may reappear again once you go to the other side of the phase transition. So the best studied example is this thing that I talked about, the onset of magnetism in rare earth alloys. It's the one that's best studied in experiment. Now, theoretically, there's a simpler problem to think about, the transition from a metal to an insulator. I'll discuss this a little bit more. And presumably, similar phenomena also happen in the cuprates. That's still not completely clarified. Now, if such a transition, which is primarily associated with the depth of the Fermi surface rather than with the onset of some Landau order parameter, is going on, then it's very natural to expect that you'll get known Fermi liquid physics. So you blame it on the fluctuations, you blame the known Fermi liquid physics on the fluctuations associated with the depth of the Fermi surface rather than with the development of magnetic order. Right? So let me give you an example from experiments of this phenomenon. So this is in one of these rare earth alloys, and what I plotted here, what the experimentalist plotted here, is some information about the geometry of the Fermi surface measured through what's known as the de Hertzmann-Alphen effect. So it's the areas of extremal surface orbits in some direction, in a direction that's perpendicular to a magnetic field. So you project the Fermi surface onto a plane perpendicular to the magnetic field and look at the areas of extremal orbits. And so this material at ambient pressure, so this axis is pressure, the horizontal axis. At ambient pressure, it's an antiferromagnetic metal. And at a finite pressure, you know, 2-something gigapascals, it undergoes a transition to a paramagnetic metal. Right? Now you see that these areas, the de Hertzmann-Alphen frequencies, don't change as a function of pressure, more or less, till you hit this magnetic phase transition. And beyond that, they jump, and you have a completely different set of frequencies. Right? So it clearly looks as though there's been a big change in the geometry of your Fermi surface. Right? So entire sheets of the Fermi surface are apparently disappearing at the phase transition. Now, you might think that this sort of thing is a clear indicator of a first order of phase transition. Things jump all the time at a first order of phase transition. But it turns out it's a bit more subtle than that. The same experiment can also measure the effective mass of the Landau quasiparticles right at the Fermi surface on these various orbits that they're executing. And this effective mass diverges as you approach this critical pressure. So it looks as though, as far as this effective mass is concerned, there's some critical singularity, and it looks as though the Fermi surface is dying in some fairly gradual manner. Right? The quasiparticles become heavier and heavier, and eventually they disappear. Right? So a simpler example is the metal-insulator transition. This is really simple to explain. Insulators, of course, don't have Fermi surfaces, while metals do. So when a metal evolves into an insulator, you somehow have to lose the Fermi surface of the metal, right, to go into the insulator. So let's think about the simplest possible example. So one way to lose the Fermi surface is that the size of the Fermi surface shrinks and it just disappears, right? So one way to lose an entire surface is to shrink the surface and then just let it go, right? Shrinks down to a point and then it goes. So this happens in this very simple example from elementary solid state physics. Imagine electrons on some lattice, they form bands, and a metal is when the Fermi energy lies in the middle of a band. And now imagine tuning the chemical potential till the Fermi energy sits in the band gap. That's an insulator. And to go from here to there, you'll have to decrease the chemical potential so that it goes through the bottom of this band and then comes right out here. Now, as you do that, you're decreasing the size of the Fermi surface till when you're exactly at the bottom of the band. It's a point, and then you've lost it. Right? So this is very simple, but it's also completely trivial. We know how to describe these, and nothing very much that's interesting goes on. So this question of how the Fermi surface dies when a metal goes into an insulator is much more interesting when the insulation is not this kind of insulator. It's not a band insulator, but it's a more exotic, more intricate kind of insulator which occurs due to Coulomb repulsion between electrons, and is known as a Mott insulator. So since at least some of you probably haven't not familiar with the what a Mott insulator is, let me describe that to you briefly. It's actually, in many ways, much simpler to explain than a band insulator because it's a purely classical phenomenon, while band insulation requires you to know quantum mechanics. So let's think about a model in which there's, on average, one electron per lattice site. Right? Electrons moving on a lattice with, on average, one electron per lattice site. And let's imagine a situation in which the Coulomb cost of two electrons occupying the same atomic orbital is very, very big. Right? So in that situation, each lattice site would like to have exactly one electron, because if it didn't, some site would have to have two electrons, and that's bad. Right? Then you had to pay the Coulomb energy cost. Right? So just this classical physics of jamming, it's like cars in a parking lot. Right? If you have too many cars, they jam. Right? And you can't move. Same phenomenon will happen here, and this the electrons can't move out of this state, because to move out of this state, you have to remove an electron and create a site with two electrons, and that's bad. Right? So this kind of insulation is known as a band insulator, and it has an odd number of electrons per unit cell, and within band theory, this would be predicted to be a metal. Right? But it's insulating for trivial reasons. It just jamming physics. So how does a Fermi surface die when a metal goes into a Mott insulator? So now, you know, we can't just shrink the size of the Fermi surface and send it to zero. Right? Because you still have, you know, charged electrons. There's one electron per lattice site that's still there in your system, even in the insulator. So this is not fully understood. But on the other hand, it is central to some of the most mysterious phenomena that we see in experiments in quantum condensed matter physics. So why is it difficult? Right? So the picture that I've given you of this Mott insulator, it was a real space picture. I told you, think of the electrons as particles. Right? And then there's jamming of these particles. While the picture of a metal, at least the standard picture of a metal, you know, occupying k-space states and forming a Fermi surface, is simple in momentum space. Right? So we have to think of the electrons as waves to describe a textbook metal. We have to think of the electrons as particles to describe the textbook Mott insulator. Right? So near this transition between the metal and the insulator, clearly neither wave nor particle points of view of the electron are more superior. Right? Because at the critical point, you have to be such that you match onto the insulator on one side, go into the particle picture, and match onto the metal on the other side, go into the wave picture. So you don't want to restrict yourself to any one of these pictures right at the critical point. And somehow, you have to find the language and the technical tools to describe the system while being agnostic on whether you want to describe the electrons in k-space or in real space. And that's difficult. So useful theoretical model to, you know, framework to think about this kind of phenomenon is what's known as the Hubbard model that probably many of you know about. Let me describe it quickly anyway. So electrons on lattice site psi with one electron per site on average. So the electrons can hop from one site to the other. And there's an on-site repulsion which penalizes energetically configurations in which there's two electrons in the same site. Now the hopping dominates, then the kinetic energy wins and you get a Fermi liquid metal. If the repulsion dominates, then, by the arguments that I gave you, you'll get a Mott insulator, right? this jamming argument would tell you that you get this insulator. So you can then pose the question within the framework of this model of how the transition between these two phases happens as you change the parameter T over U. Okay? So this kind of thing has also been studied experimentally, most spectacularly in this material, which is a two-dimensional layer, two-dimensional material. So at ambient pressure, it's a Mohr insulator with no Fermi surface, obviously. And under pressure, it goes into a metal with, you know, has an electron Fermi surface. At low temperatures, it goes superconducting, but that's a different story. So then in this context, one can ask what happens to the Fermi surface of this metal as you go from here to there. So the Fermi surface can't shrink to zero in this problem, unlike the trivial example that I gave earlier, because the size of the Fermi surface is fixed by the density of electrons, right? And we're not changing the density of electrons as we tune pressure. Right? The number of electrons per unit cell stays fixed, right? So the size of the Fermi surface is fixed. The total area of the Fermi surface is fixed. And we can't shrink it to zero. So we have to maintain the Fermi surface with its fixed area and somehow get rid of it. Right? So that's the challenge. Anyway, so that's what I've already said. So this entire Fermi surface of the metal needs to disappear as we go from metal to insulator. Right? It needs to disappear in one shot. So similar things might happen in the high-temperature superconducting materials. I said that's, as with anything else in that field, a matter of some controversy, and so I'll skip describing that. So the basic and fundamental question for theory is, how can this happen? How can an entire Fermi surface disappear continuously? Right? You have a surface of a fixed area on one side, no surface on the other side. Can the transition be continuous? So the more basic question which I should address is what the Fermi surface is in an interacting Fermi fluid as opposed to the free Fermi gas. So the free Fermi gas, we are used to characterizing the Fermi surface by looking at the occupation number in momentum space. It has this, it's 1 for k below the Fermi surface and it's 0 for k above. So you get this step discontinuity in the occupation number. Now the interacting Fermi gas, in the Landau Fermi liquid phase, it turns out that there's still a jump discontinuity at the Fermi surface, but the size of the jump is reduced from 1 to some number traditionally denoted z that's smaller than 1. But there's still a jump, right? And this jump is a measure of the extent to which the electron overlaps with the Landau quasiparticle, right? The extent to which the bare electron overlaps with the dressed electron, that is your low energy, is your low energy particle, right? So when the Fermi surface is disappeared, this n of k, this function n of k, necessarily is a smooth function, right? There's no singularities anywhere. Right? In an insulator, n of k is a smooth function of k. So this jump discontinuity in n of k has disappeared once you go into the insulator. So there's a very old idea in this field going back 40 years due to Brinkman and Rice, which suggested that this disappearance of the Fermi surface can happen continuously if this jump discontinuity vanishes continuously as you approach the transition. Since there's no jump in the insulator and there is a jump in the metal, the jump goes to zero, then you've accomplished this story. Right? So it turns out that by now there are many ways to get concrete examples of this scenario within some model calculation, but I won't discuss that in this talk. So things, you know, so this immediately then raises the next question, which is the following. So we say that this jump is going to zero at the critical point, but then what about the excitations right at the critical point? How are we going to think about the electronic spectrum of this material when it's sitting right at the critical point, right at the brink of the transition between the metal and the insulator, right? So what is the electronic structure at criticality? So I'm going to make a very simple claim. I'm going to claim that right at the critical point, the Fermi surface remains sharply defined even though you've lost the Landau quasiparticle, right? So you lost the Landau quasiparticle because your Z, this jump discontinuity, went to zero, which means that the overlap between the bare electron and any low energy excitation is zero, right? So there's no quasiparticle description of the low energy spectrum anymore. But nevertheless, my claim is that the Fermi surface remains sharply defined, right? And this is what I've called a critical Fermi surface. So let me tell you what the argument is. It's ridiculously simple. So let's think about this example of the Mott transition, which is easy to think about. And let's ask the following question. Right? Suppose I came in from the outside world and I wanted to add an electron to the system at some definite momentum k. Right? And let me ask about the minimum energy that it takes for me to do that at any given moment, point k in the below zone of this material. Now, in the Fermi liquid phase, by definition, this minimum gap is zero so long as K lies exactly at the Fermi surface. Right? So right at the Fermi surface, I can add an extra electron with no energy cost. Right? Now, in the Mott insulator, on the other hand, it's an insulator, and there's a sharp gap to adding an electron at any K point. Right? There's a sharp threshold before there's any onset of weight in the electron spectrum. So there's a delta of k that's sharply defined as non-zero for all k in the insulator. Right? So now let's ask how we go between these two phases. Right? So clearly, if the transition is continuous, then this gap to adding an electron in the insulator must go to zero continuously. So if there is a second order transition from the insulator to the metal, then this delta of k will close continuously. But now, let's ask at what k points is delta of k going to close? Right? Well, when it closes, if you have to match on to the behavior of the metal on the other side, then it must necessarily go to zero, right at where the Fermi surface of the metal used to be. Right? That's the only way it can match to the other side. Right? So this then tells you that the Fermi surface is still a privileged surface right at the critical point. That's where the gap to adding an electron has just gone to zero. Right? And it stays zero throughout the Fermi liquid phase. But coming from the insulator, that's where you first lose the gap to adding an electron. Right? So there is still a privileged surface right at the critical point, which is exactly the Fermi surface of the metal on the other side. So the Fermi surface is a sharply defined surface even right at the critical point, even though you've lost the Landau quasiparticle. Yeah? No, not necessarily. So the question is what happens if the insulating side becomes magnetic at the same time? For this argument, nothing happens. But there's a more fundamental question, which is whether such a transition can be second order at all in the first place. And we don't know the answer to that question. You know, the experiments on these rare earth materials suggest that maybe that's possible. But theoretically, despite, you know, maybe 10 years of effort, we have no idea at all whether such a transition can be second order. But if it is second order, then you're guaranteed to have this critical Fermi surface right at the critical point. But in addition to the fact that the Fermi surface has gone critical, different points on the Fermi surface will also behave differently. There'll be hot spots on the Fermi surface which are more critical than the other points on the Fermi surface. So what we have right at the critical point is a very interesting, you know, these very general arguments tell you that right at the critical point, we have a very interesting state of matter. It's clearly a non-Fermi liquid because you've lost the Landau quasiparticle. You no longer have a finite overlap between the quasiparticle and the bare electron. Right? So there's no Landau quasiparticle, therefore it's a non-Fermi liquid. On the other hand, it has a sharp Fermi surface. So it's a weird state that retains the Fermi surface of the metal but has lost the quasiparticle of the metal. Right? So that's a non-Fermi liquid metal of a certain kind. So another way to think about it is that if you think about this N of K, it has this jump in the metal, it's smooth in the insulator, and right at the critical point, when it's this jump has just gone to zero, you expect that the instead of this big singularity, meaning there's a jump, there's a milder singularity where perhaps there's a kink or something of that sort. But that still means that Kf is where there is some singularity in N of K, and therefore the system has a well-defined Fermi surface. Anyway, so this is what I've repeated many times by now. So this observation immediately raises a number of questions that we don't know the answers to. This means that the critical phenomena or problem that we have to solve to confront these kinds of phase transitions where entire Fermi surfaces die is very unusual, because the critical modes now live on an entire surface in momentum space, unlike any other examples that we're familiar with from, you know, ordinary critical phenomena, where the critical modes sit at isolated points of momentum space. You know, and then they're described by some ordinary field theory. For instance, the Ising model is described by the spontaneous fluctuations of the Ising order parameter near k equals zero. Then you write a continuum phi 4 theory to describe the transition. Right? But here, the critical modes live on a surface in momentum space. And what are we going to do? Right? And even simple things like scaling, which for ordinary critical phenomena were developed before we had a theory or theoretical framework for the transition, even things like scaling will have to be revisited. And you know, one has to develop a new scaling phenomenology, and one needs, presumably, almost certainly, one needs a new calculational framework. Right? But this at least gives us some handle, some direction, in terms of which we should be thinking about how to describe these phase transitions and the resulting non-Fermi liquid physics. So let me very, very briefly sketch for you some ideas that I developed a couple of years back on scaling phenomenology for this kind of phase transition. So the idea is to focus, at least initially, on the density of states for adding or removing an electron, I guess in this case, removing an electron from the material. So let's define this quantity, which is this matrix element squared. You know, it's something that would occur in a Fermi golden rule type calculation, with the probability of removing an electron from this material with momentum k and energy omega. So it's matrix element squared times some delta function, which describes this process of removing an electron with some energy. So if you indeed have this critical Fermi surface, then one should expect that this universal scale invariant singularity in this electron density of states for small omega and for small k parallel, where k parallel is the distance in momentum space between the k point that you're examining and the Fermi surface. Right? So for every point theta on the Fermi surface, one should expect that this object, this density of states, has some power law singularity, which depends in some scale invariant manner on the frequency, and there's some power of this momentum, this distance and momentum from the Fermi surface. Right? So this is the natural generalization of standard scaling laws that describe critical singularity, say for the Ising model. Right? So the new feature here is that we are scaling towards a surface in momentum space, rather than towards a point in momentum space. But another new possible feature is that we, you know, so all these phenomena in condensed matter occur in the presence of a lattice, in which case there is no spatial, continuous spatial rotational symmetry. At best, you have discrete lattice rotational symmetry. And logically, it's possible that this symmetry does not tell us that these exponents, these critical exponents that are introduced in the scaling unsorts, have to be the same at every point of the Fermi surface. Right? They only have to be the same under some discrete lattice rotations, but they're not. I mean, there's no general requirement that they're the same for continuous rotations as they continuously move around the Fermi surface. So then we should allow for these exponents to depend on angle on the Fermi surface and build a scaling theory that allows for that possibility. So instead of exponents characterizing the transition, if this could happen, we'd have exponent functions, functions of an angle that characterize the transition. So the only thing that you can say, for instance, on a triangular lattice, is that these exponents come back to themselves after 60-degree rotation. But beyond that, one doesn't know anything about these functions. And if one leaves the critical point, one should imagine that this, one would imagine that this universal scale invariant spectrum is cut off at some momentum scale that I'll call 1 over psi, so that defines a length scale, and a corresponding frequency scale, so there's a generalized scaling unsorts for that captures the deviations from criticality. And once again, one should expect by analogy with, say, the Ising model, that this length scale would diverge as a power law of the distance from the critical point, but a priori, we must allow for the possibility that this exponent nu depends on where you are on the Fermi surface. So different points may scale differently. Right? So one can build on this thing and develop a scaling theory for various other quantities. So this, even the scaling thing is not fully developed yet because it's hard. And for things like transport, it's not clear how to do this, how to develop scaling theory for such a critical Fermi surface. But there are many, already at the level to which it's been developed so far, it's clear that there are many phenomenological differences with ordinary criticality. For instance, if you think about the specific heat right at the critical point, so this is the specific heat, it's given within the scaling theory as an integral over the Fermi surface of singular contributions coming from each separate portion of the Fermi surface. Each portion contributes a power law temperature dependence. But if this exponent, these exponents can vary around the Fermi surface, then these different portions contribute different singular contributions, and the net sum is dominated by one portion of the Fermi surface, the portion where this contribution is most singular. Right? So we have this phenomenon that the criticality in the specific heat will predominantly come from one small portion of the Fermi surface, even though the entire Fermi surface has gone critical. Now, if you measure some other quantity, then which is also integrated over the Fermi surface, then its dominant critical singularities may come from from some other different portion of the Fermi surface. Right? So once these exponents depend on angle, the phenomenology can become more literally complicated. And if this is true, it will be very, very hard to disentangle from these angled integrated probes, probes that don't distinguish between different portions of Fermi surface, about the true nature of the underlying criticality. Right? But these are the most common kinds of things that experimentalists tend to do, simply because they're the easiest things to measure. So there's another weird implication of this possibility of angle-dependent exponents. This is the one that I've already talked about. But if you think about how the system emerges out of criticality, then this possibility of angle-dependent exponents means that different portions of the Fermi surface will emerge out of criticality at different energy scales. Right? So for example, at the Mott transition, the scale at which the system emerges out of the critical region and goes into the insulating side, for instance, is set by the Mott gap, the gap to add an electron to any given portion of the Fermi surface. And that gap will scale as a function of distance from the critical point with some exponent, which in principle might depend on angle. So now we see that, you know, as a function of, let's say, temperature, there'll always be an intermediate temperature regime in which your temperature is smaller than the local gap on the Fermi surface in some portions of the Fermi surface, and bigger than the local gap in some other portions of the Fermi surface. Then in this intermediate temperature regime, it will look to you, when you do an experiment, that you only have portions of the Fermi surface left. Right? So the picture is like this. So those of you who do quantum critical phenomena will recognize these sorts of fan diagrams. So usually you just have a single fan, right? But here, what happens is that as you go out of this critical region, come down in energy scale, slightly away from the critical point, initially you don't realize that you're away from the critical point. So you more or less behave as though you have a full Fermi surface. And then you come down, you start opening gaps in some portions of the Fermi surface, but not in others. Right? It looks as though you have a partially truncated Fermi surface. And this partially truncated Fermi surface, I'll call it a Fermi arc. This Fermi arc, this length of this Fermi arc will decrease as you decrease the temperature till you fall below the smallest possible gap when you go into the insulator. Right? So you'll have this weird intermediate temperature regime state where it looks like your Fermi surface has been partially chopped off. Right? That's extremely weird. But on the other hand, this is exactly the kind of thing that people have been reporting for more than 10 years now when the cuprate superconductors are above the superconducting transition temperature. And we don't know what's going on in that state. This Fermi arc state was discovered in the late 90s, and a large number of theoretical ideas that have been generated to describe these Fermi arcs, it's not clear whether which one of them or if any of them is right. But at least I want to throw one more, at least as a philosophical, as a logical possibility to that thing, and say that this kind of state emerges naturally within this framework, right? Without doing any calculation. You know, it's just it's a natural consequence of the possibility of these angle-dependent exponents. Okay, so that was scaling. So what calculations are we going to do to put some teeth on any of this stuff? You know, how are we going to develop a theoretical framework? So this is very much undeveloped. So there's some concrete results that I'll briefly advertise. So there is a theoretical methodology that condensed matter physicists have dreamed up to deal with some class of exotic phenomena in strongly coupled many-body systems, which go under the name of slave particle methods. So the idea is to view, to represent the electron as a inside this many-body medium as a composite of more fundamental degrees of freedom. Right? And these more fundamental things are obviously going to be fractions of the electron. So you're just going to make these up, right? And those are called slave particles because, you know, we just made them up initially, right? But it turns out that under many circumstances, under some circumstances, these slaves can be liberated and they take on, they become reasonably good quasi-particles in the system, right? So the most famous example of this, but very simple, happens in the fractional quantum Hall effect where you get the phenomenon of fractional quantum numbers. My use of this kind of thing here is much, much more delicate, but it's on fairly solid theoretical ground, because I'm trying to describe a state that is metallic, it's gapless, blah, blah, blah. So what we do is to reformulate the electron model in terms of the slave particles, but at the cost of introducing some extra forces between the slave particles that keep track of the fact that microscopically, these fractions were all glued together to form an electron. Right? It's only in the low-energy emergent sense that these slaves become liberated, but at short distances, the slaves are confined. If you wish, it's the opposite of asymptotic freedom. You know, for quarks and QCD, things are deconfined at high energies, confined at low energies. Well, here we have confinement at high energies, deconfinement at low energies. Right? So this methodology, so I've worked out several examples of this, of concrete examples of phase transitions where an entire Fermi surface disappears continuously and demonstrated the existence of critical Fermi surfaces and, worked out the known Fermi liquid behavior that accompanies it, and using this methodology in several examples in various pieces of work. So these are important, at least as proofs of principle, that this kind of thing gives a viable mechanism for the continuous depth of a Fermi surface, the formation of a critical Fermi surface, and the emergence of known Fermi liquid behavior at such a critical point. Right? So at least we have one concrete theoretical example in our hands. Right? Now the application experiment, I myself am a bit more pessimistic on this than many of the other people in the field, so I think that one has to proceed with a lot of caution. And I'm a bit skeptical that this directly describes, for instance, the experiment that I showed you on these rare earth alloys and things of that sort. At this instant of time, maybe there'll be other systems in the future where one doesn't have to be that pessimistic. Now, my friend John McGreevy is here. And so I should tell you about some very intriguing work that John and our other colleague Hong Liu did with their students last year. So inspired by all these developments in condensed matter physics and all the puzzles that we were facing, so these guys decided to see just as exploration in theory space, just as I was exploring in theory space, whether you could construct an ADS dual for a non-Fermi liquid state, right? So take a strongly coupled field theory, conformal field theory, and imagine doping it by turning on a chemical potential to produce finite charge density for a conserved globally conserved U1 charge, and imagine that it has an ADS dual, and examine the possibility of a Fermi surface and known Fermi liquid physics in that resulting ADS calculation. And there's all kinds of interesting results that have been found. It's a very, very long shot, obviously. You know, I'm so pessimistic about the application experiment that even this, which is more microscopically well-motivated, I'm skeptical about its direct relevance to the rare earth alloy experiments. So given that stand, I can't help but be skeptical of the direct relevance of this to the experiments. But I think, you know, we have to take the point of view, since these problems are so difficult, that we have to explore in theory space and see what we can learn. And so I'm hoping that John will teach me something that will be useful for, you know, this set of ideas. Anyway, so let me summarize. I think I'm it's time, right? So what I've tried to show to you is that at certain quantum phase transitions in metals, an entire Fermi surface of the metal may disappear. And listed a number of possible examples. So if these transitions are second order, then non-Fermi liquid physics is natural at such a quantum critical point. And this, I think, is a very important clue from experiments on how to go about constructing a theory of the non-Fermi liquid state that is routinely being seen in a large number of materials, you know, every year. Right? So there's a crisis for solid-state physics. Right? We need a new framework, and this is the best clue that we have on what to concentrate on, you know, focus on how the Fermi surface dies. So intuition from ordinary quantum critical points that we've developed over 25, 30 years is probably dangerous because that is far too simple a problem. You have to deal with things living on a Fermi surface and things of that sort. It's much, much more, it's a much more sophisticated problem than just simple, say, quantum critical points in magnetic insulators or in cold atom systems, things of that sort. Those we understand, at least conceptually, you know, there's always details that So I've argued that the natural way for the Fermi surface to die continuously is for you to lose the quasiparticle but preserve the Fermi surface all the way up to the critical point. So then you have to deal with this critical Fermi surface in describing anything about the phase transition. So there are concrete model calculations that exist, but really you have to go beyond proofs of principle now and, you know, confront the real world, and that hasn't happened yet. Thanks.
So in view of the noise, we'll use the microphones. Please wait until I get it to you.
So you showed this property of the resistivity being linear with the temperature. Do you have any idea how your model could fit that?
It doesn't. I mean, sorry, let me give you a more nuanced answer. So, it depends on what you meant by model. I mean,
with the angular
dependence. That's not a model, that's phenomenology. No, that's a scaling framework. And scaling will tell you that the resistivity will be some power law in temperature. That's the best that scaling can tell you. Scaling will not tell you what the exponent is. Right? So we are asking why the exponent is 1. You know, that's the question. And that is beyond the purview of scaling. So in that sense, there's no apologies in saying that this thing can't predict it. It might. We don't know enough. You know, as with all of these problems, you know, scaling without more microscopic things, one can never know the answer. You know, one really needs something more than scaling to answer a question of that sort.
Yeah, I have two questions. In the example you showed for the ytterbium-rhodium,
yeah,
the temperature range where resistivity is linear goes from 0.1 to about 2 Kelvin or something like that.
Yeah, nearly 3.
So is it known, at least for this compound, as you keep cranking up the temperature, how this linear behavior crosses over to something else? So the right-hand side graph there, if you keep cranking the temperature, where does it go?
I don't know. I mean, but people obviously have measured it to very high temperature. And, man, there's all kinds of bad things that happen once you go beyond a few Kelvin range. There's crystal field excitations that come in. Then you cross the Kondo scale and you go into this incoherent regime where the local moments are incoherent and the electrons are scattering off them. So those are...
Yeah, but you know why I'm asking that, right? Because you showed the same picture for the cuprate,
yeah,
where there you went, you showed from 5 Kelvin to 1,000 Kelvin,
yes,
but then you run out of steam,
right,
because you,
right,
just destroyed a crystal at 1,000 Kelvin.
That's right, yeah.
But
here we know that you don't have to wait till you melt the crystal to do something bad to the system. Right? More microscopic, unimportant things come into play at much lower temperature scales. But here the evidence for this linear T is in fact better, not because you can go up even higher in temperature, but because you can go down even lower in temperature. So it's in, for 3 decades in temperature, but, you know, it's mostly going down to very low temperature.
In conventional critical phenomena, right, the idea of scaling, right, is tied to hyperscaling and the unique time scale and length scale, right? And this,
yeah,
all the scaling relations emerge out of the scaling hypothesis for the free energy.
Yes.
But here you just ad hoc write a scaling for this response function. And so there's no control on how these exponents can be related by scaling, right? It just...
No. Okay, so let me answer that. Scaling, it doesn't matter where you start. Right? From a... Historically, what you said is correct. Historically, people postulated a scaling form for the free energy. and derived everything else from that. But that's, I think, a historical accident. Now, from a fundamental theoretical point of view, even for the Ising model, what we would do is to start from the scaling form of the two-point correlation function and then go to, you know, more complicated correlation functions, right? No, so here there's a reason why I did not want to do the free energy, because the free energy is not angle resolved. And in the depends of the surface, you know, the specific heat is an example, right? It integrates over the singular contributions of everything. So starting from the two-point fermion Green's function, which is this A of K omega, that's the useful conceptual starting point. One tries to build a theory starting from that. But really, going beyond this two-particle thing, you know, the specific heat, I can use some indirect arguments starting from the two-particle, from the, you know, from the simplest green two-point function. I can cook up an argument for the specific heat, but for more complicated two-particle response, like transport, this scaling answer is not enough, and one has to do something for a multi-particle Green's function, which is much more complicated, and that has never been carried through. At least when I tried to do it, I ran into difficulties. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
Hi, thanks for it. It was a beautiful talk. I'm interested in the idea of the slave, the decomposition of the electron into particles, quasi-particles with fractional statistics. If I understood you right, bound together by some gauge field.
Sorry, I'm not able to resolve different words. I think maybe with the mic.
Well, sorry, is it better if I hold it like this?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So the idea that you called slave particles.
Yeah.
That the electron can decompose into a bound state of particles with fractional quantum numbers held together by gauge fields.
Right.
Okay. So that seems reminiscent of what used to be called prion models in high energy physics, which were actual models for constituents of quarks and leptons made up of particles with fractional charges. And those ran into severe problems with quantum consistency. You could not have the fractionally charged particles held together by gauge fields and have consistent coupling of gauge fields for the quarks and leptons. Do you run into, presumably your context is 2 plus 1?
Oh, it can be 3 plus 1. It can be, I don't know, since John has said, it can be 10 plus 1. in any number of dimensions, we can carry through this kind of program.
And you don't run into issues of consistency. The issues had to do with chiral interactions and consistency of coupling of chiral interactions.
Yeah, maybe these problems are much simpler. So
there's no chiral.
And yeah, I'm not sure what the issue there was, but here there's many, many solid examples theoretically of models where this kind of phenomenon can be demonstrated to happen. They're exactly soluble models, approximately soluble models. There's numerical work by, among other people, Roger Melko, Pierre. So theoretically, it's in very good shape.
Good. And is this in 2 plus 1, or are there also models like this in 3 plus 1?
There are models in 3 plus 1, too, which numerically not in such good shape, but analytically are in very good shape. I mean, meaning there are exactly soluble models in 3 plus 1. There are approximately solved, more realistic, but approximately solvable models, and all of these things are in very firm theoretical ground.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Finish there and thank the speaker once more.